Welcome to Breitbart News Daily, the podcast version.
Thanks for being here.
We'll present here our opening segment where we talk about some of the jurors in the Donald Trump trial and compare it to John Adams. We had a ton of guests on the show today. Let me pull up the list here. We had John Nolte, A.W.R. Hawkins, Congressman Mike Waltz, only the first Green Beret to be in Congress, Senator Ron Johnson, and Vicky Paladino, who we're going to play here. Vicky Paladino was so awesome and so perfect and so exactly what I wanted the city councilman in New York from Queens to be. She was amazing. So I can't wait. Honestly, you just skip ahead if you need to and just listen just to her. She was amazing about the illegal aliens who went in front of the city council complaining that the food's no good and the hotel accommodations are no good and you guys spend too much money on police officers and you're giving me tampons and in Africa we don't use tampons and that's offensive and xenophobic and you're anti-African. And she was there and she finally blew up on them and she gave it to us today as well. She was awesome. But first, let's play our opening segment where we talk about the trial and John Adams. All right, I'm going to give a juror some kudos. We're giving kudos out this morning. First thing, you have plenty to give. They're free to give. So give them when you see someone who deserves them. I'm giving kudos to this juror right here.
One of the jurors called up the court to inform them that she did not know whether she could actually be fair and impartial. She was asked to come to court this morning and went before the defense and went before the district attorney's office and answered questions about how she got to that conclusion. And she said in part that she got calls just yesterday alone from, quote, friends, colleagues and family, quote, questioning my identity as a juror. She continued, I don't believe I can be fair and unbiased and let the outside influences not affect me in the courtroom. This hits at the heart of the difficulty for these jurors over the course of the next 6 to 8 weeks. These are individuals who, they are anonymous, yet we and the sides have some details about who these individuals are, their neighborhoods, their occupation.
Yeah, this is pretty good. So good for that woman to be like, you know what? I actually can't do this. Now, I'm very curious what her friends and family members said to her. What did they tell her? What caused her to go home, to be on the jury, and be like be in the court and be like, I can do this, and then go home, and then go back and be like, I can't do this. Actually, what did her family and friends say to her? Were they threatening her? Like, oh, you better lock them away. You better lock them up. What did they say to her that caused her to realize that she can't be non-biased? Now, it would take a person of remarkable integrity to be non-biased in this trial, or a person of complete ignorance, which is possible too, right? If you've been in a coma in the last 10 years, then you could be perhaps a bit unbiased as well. But otherwise, to go there and serve in a non-biased way would be very impressive. I mean, you know, people with TDS. You're going in there with TDS, and we expect you to be non-biased. I don't even know if it's possible. I don't think it's possible. I don't think a random sampling of 12 New Yorkers in a county that voted 85 to 15 for Biden could pull it off. You would need John Adams Boston Massacre level of integrity in order to go there every day and judge properly. Remember John Adams, he defended the British in the Boston Massacre. He defended the British. His famous closing statement. We had British soldiers murdered 5 colonists, injured 6 others. And I found the speech from the John Adams miniseries, which has come up a little bit lately in passing because the Ben Franklin miniseries is out right now and I cannot watch it. I will not watch it. Even the John Adams one, which has done really well, this speech isn't entirely real. And I think that's really annoying. This is close, though, this speech. I compared this speech I'm going to play with his actual speech, the text of it, And it's pretty close. They moved lines around. The biggest sin was they skipped over a lot of good stuff as well for the sake of it. But this is pretty close, so I thought it was worth points. So this is John Adams defending the British soldiers who killed five colonists.
Prisoners must be judged solely upon the evidence produced against them in court and by nothing else.
Do you think they're going to be able to do that against Donald Trump? You must only judge him based off the evidence produced in court, not his Muslim ban, not comments you think he's said about women, not things you've heard through Rachel Maddow, not your friends and family, what they say about him or what they say about you if you don't judge him in a court. Can they do that?
We have heard speaks plainly enough, gentlemen. A sentry's post is his castle, and to attack it by English law is an illegal act. Soldiers so assaulted may defend themselves to the death. And the people are crying, kill them, kill them, knock them down. And the heaving sharp cutting ice, oyster shells, clubs. What are they to do? Behave like stoic philosophers lost in apathy? Disregard these uniforms. Consider the men who wear them. Consider yourselves in such a situation and judge if a reasonable man would not fear for his life. Facts are stubborn things. Whatever our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictums of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence.
That's a real line at the end there. There's such good stuff they leave out, though. Check out this line. So that line, what do you expect? They should behave like a stoic philosopher lost in apathy? The next line in real life is patient as Epictetus, while his master was breaking his legs with a cudgel. Our founding fathers loved that story. They loved that. They wrote about it all the time. Epictetus, this is like the year zero or something, a Stoic philosopher. The story was that when he was a slave, his master was twisting his leg to torture him. And Epictetus had such total and complete composure over himself. He had such mastery over his body and his emotions, and such a deep understanding of the Stoic idea is that there's things that are under my control and things that are not under my control, and I will not focus at all on the things that are not in my control, but I will only focus on the things that are in my control. And he had such complete control over that, or such an understanding of that, that as his leg is being broken, he told his master, if you keep twisting, you will break my leg. And he said it with complete composure, just complete calm, because it wasn't under his control whether or not this was continuing to happen. All that's in his control is how he reacts. So he says, sir, you're twisting my leg, and if you keep twisting it, you're going to break it. And then the master broke it. And Epictetus says, there, did I not tell you that it would break? And I cannot express how much our founding fathers loved that story. They wrote about it to each other. They wrote about it in their journals. John and Abigail wrote about it to each other. All the literature of that day would reference Epictetus and his leg getting broken. John Adams threw it in his closing statement of the Boston Massacre. This story of the Epictetus' broken leg was as known as any pop culture reference could be known today. What's a pop culture thing today that everyone knows? I don't even know. What's like a pop culture reference I can make? What's happening in the pop culture world today? Zach, do you have any? What's like a pop culture thing? I can't even think about it. What's one thing going on in the pop culture world that I could be like, oh, it's like that. I don't
Taylor
even know.
Swift.
There you go. It'd be like, oh, is it, what is he supposed to act like, Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour? And everyone would be like, oh yeah, Taylor Swift. I've heard of that. That's what Epictetus' broken leg was. Isn't that amazing? So good. What do you expect him to behave like a stoic philosopher lost in apathy? Patient as Epictetus while his master was breaking his legs with a cudgel? All right, but here's the line they took out. John Adams, this is at the end. John Adams says, the law, in all vicissitudes of government, fluctuations of the passions or flights of enthusiasm will preserve a steady, undeviating course. It, the law, will not bend to the uncertain wishes, imaginations, and wanton tempers of men. To use the words of a great and worthy man, a patriot, a hero, an enlightened friend of mankind, and a martyr to liberty, I mean Algernon Sidney, I've never heard of him, who from his earliest infancy sought a tranquil retirement under the shadow of the tree of liberty, with his tongue, his pen, and his sword. The law, says he, no passion can disturb. 'Tis void of desire and fear, lust and anger. Then he reads a Latin line. Written reason, retaining some measure of the divine perfection. It does not enjoin that which pleases a weak, frail man, but without any regard to persons, commands that which is good and punishes evil in all, whether rich or poor, high or low. 'Tis deaf, inexorable, inflexible. The point is, don't put your hatred about the British on these men. You must only look at the facts. Facts are stubborn things. You must only look at the facts of this case and nothing else. And I think we were a virtuous enough people, even back then in 1770, that the British soldiers were acquitted of their crimes. I don't think we're a virtuous enough people to just look at the facts today. But I will hand it to this woman. Good for her. Good for her for coming back and saying, I can't do this. I can't be non-biased. And the truth is, I would want that person on the jury. If I was Trump's lawyers, I'd say, no, no, no. You're perfect. The fact that you are aware of your inability to be non-biased, the fact that you are aware of the pressures that are being put upon you by your friends and your family, I think that means you are most qualified to be on that jury. The other 11 and the person who they replaced her with, they're going on this jury thinking, oh yeah, no problem. I could be non-biased. Sure, I hate him, but I can look at this impartially. I can do this by the letter of the law. I can maybe find him not guilty, even if it means absolutely being destroyed by my family and abandoned by my friend group. Politico yesterday reported that there's people in the Biden White House who call Trump Hitler pig. Hitler pig. They call him Hitler pig in the White House. Now, the Politico made the point that these are younger staffers, not so much the boomers in the White House, but people in the actual White House, they refer to Trump as Hitler pig. So someone is on the jury and they are deluded enough to think that they can be non-biased in a trial, maybe find him not guilty, to the point where they can go back to their work and their friend group and their family, who will tell them that you had the chance to put Hitler pig in prison and you didn't take it? And you expect that person to respond with the details and the intricacies of the law and what evidence was shown and what evidence wasn't shown and, oh, I couldn't consider the fact that he's a misogynist. I couldn't consider the fact that he had a Muslim ban. I couldn't consider the fact that he put kids in cages. I couldn't consider that. I only had to consider X and not Y. No chance. No chance will a juror have the integrity to do that, except for maybe that woman. That woman may be the only one who would do it because she's aware. She's aware of her own frailties, weaknesses, insecurities, isn't it? She's aware of her own what? She's aware of her own inadequacies, her own inadequacies. And that person is way more qualified. I would have kept her. Yesterday, I talked to Alan Dershowitz just because I got a lot of fundamental questions about this trial. I think this is incredible. It's going to start on Monday. So I talked to Alan Dershowitz. And I listened to this yesterday. I was like, oh, I want to play a couple clips of it. And I was like, I couldn't stop it. There's so much good here. And he's so quick. He just, like, you ask a question, he answers the question. There's no fluff here. So I'm like, I think we just got to play almost all of it here. So anyway, sit back and enjoy. This is Alan Dershowitz.
How is it possible that this judge could donate to Joe Biden and to a group called Stop Republicans and not be recused from the case?
Well, that's only one of many criteria that should apply to him. His daughter is apparently making money just by the fact that he is the trial judge. And if there is a conviction, she'll make more money by raising funds for Democrats off this trial. We know that that's certainly going to happen. And so his daughter can financially benefit from his rulings. And this is such a clear case for recusal. It's not even close. And there are so many judges in New York, many of whom hate Trump as much, who could sit on the case without there being the appearance of conflict of interest, that this judge is acting very foolishly in remaining on the case. But, you know, he would like to be the one to get the credit for convicting Donald Trump and destroying his presidential campaign, which is what he's doing. This case is paradigmatic election interference. There's nothing to the case at all. It's a made up case. It could be done against you and me or anybody else, number one. Number two, the judge should have no right to keep him in the courtroom. He should have an absolute right to leave the courtroom anytime he wants, except if he has to be identified or if there's a reason for him being in the courtroom. In most, many states and in the federal court, a defendant has the right to be a trial, but the right not to be a trial. Even under the New York statute, you can make a motion, but there has to be consent by the prosecution to be relieved from being at the trial on a given day. And the prosecution shouldn't have that power. He has the right to be there. They have no right to make him be there.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. All right. So there's, how does it normally work in a criminal trial in New York? Can you leave if you want to not be there?
Here's a motion. It's called Section 340.5. On motion by the defendant, the court may, and then here's the key sentence, may, in the absence of an objection by the people, issue an order dispensing with the requirement that the defendant be there. Now, it's unconstitutional to give the prosecution the power to make him stay in the court when he's running for president. He has a First Amendment right, and we have a First Amendment right to hear him. Look, I'm not here making a political case for Donald Trump. I don't know who I'm going to vote for. I have an open mind, but I want the election to be fair. I don't want the thumb, or in this case, the elbow, of a weaponized criminal justice system to determine the outcome of this election. And right now, this case can have a big impact in two different ways. Number one, it'll keep him campaigning. Here we have President Biden campaigning daily in Pennsylvania, a key state, and Trump has to start his campaigning at 6 o'clock at night, and he'll be exhausted to court the next day. He has the right, and we have the right to hear him and to listen to his point. And that clearly should outweigh any claim that the government has for keeping him in the courtroom. They have no right to have him present at the trial. He only has the right to be present if he chooses to be there.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that fascinating? The fact he doesn't have to be there. So I'm reading this New York Criminal Code 340.5. A defendant must be personally present during the trial. Ah, there it is, Slater. He has to be there. Part two. On motion of a defendant represented by counsel, so his lawyers, the court may, in the absence of an objection by the people, issue an order dispensing with the requirement that the defendant be personally present at trial. He can waive his right to be personally present at trial and authorizing his attorney to conduct his defense. So in a sane world, if this weren't lawfare, Trump's lawyers could be like, we'd like to waive his right to be here. And they'd say, and the lawyers, the other side would say, okay, no problem. And then he would leave, and that's it. And the trial would go on. But no, you must sit there. The Sixth Amendment, I'm reading here, guarantees an accused right to be confronted and the witnesses against it. Right. So the Sixth Amendment is Trump has the right to know who's accusing him. It's not that the accusers have the right for Trump to sit there during an entire trial. It's the other way around. So there's example two, the big second big one of lawfare, right? Number one is, well, that the case is happening, but the fact that the judge is donated to a group called Stop Republicans. But the other one is that he has to sit there through the whole thing.
Is there any, have they given a justification as to why, first of all, is it up to the judge about him being there? And has he given any reason why he demands that he must be there every day?
Well, it normally is up to the judge, but not under the unconstitutional New York statute. The New York statute says the court may, in the absence of an objection by the people. You can't have the prosecution, one side of an adversarial system, having the final say. So it should be up to the judge, and the judge should allow him to leave. I have never heard of a case where a criminal defendant was not allowed to attend his own son's graduation or couldn't attend an argument in the Supreme Court involving his future. This judge is abusing his discretion, and the statute itself is unconstitutional. Look, this judge has engaged in unconstitutional conduct repeatedly. Imposing a gag order that stops him from complaining about the witnesses who are testifying against him. He has the right to tell the public these witnesses are liars. You know, the porn star has already signed a statement saying that, you know, they didn't have sex or, you know, there was no money paid. Obviously, he's entitled to bring that to the attention of the public. This is a public trial. This is a political trial. And he has the right to defend himself in the court of public opinion as well as in the court of law. So that's an unconstitutional restriction. Also, he's entitled to complain about the judge's daughter making money off this case. That's something the public has the right to hear from him. So the judge is violating the Constitution on a daily basis.
What is a normal, proper use of a gag order that makes it clear that this is an abuse of a gag order?
Well, gag orders generally are applied to prevent the public from learning about evidence that the jury should not know about. For example, if the police beat a confession out of somebody and he admits to the crime, but it wouldn't be admissible at trial, there is a gag order saying to the prosecution, you can't disclose the fact that he's admitted his guilt because that will get to the jury. So influencing the jury, obviously threats against jurors, individual jurors, can be prohibited. But generally, gag orders are frowned upon because they're a prior restraint. I argued the Pentagon Papers case in the United States Supreme Court on behalf of Senator Gravel, wrote the brief, and the Supreme Court rejected prior restraint. And a gag order is a prior restraint. It's telling somebody if you talk, you will be held in contempt. And courts look askance on any prior restraint, and particularly gag orders have to be viewed very, very narrowly. Now, the gag order does to attack the judge, and he's taking full advantage of that, but it doesn't allow him to attack the judge's daughter, and he should be allowed to because she's part of the reason why the judge should be recused in this case.
And one more question on the recusal. Who is in charge of deciding if the judge is recused? Is it the judge?
Initially, the judge makes the decision, but then it can be appealed, and it can be appealed both before the trial under a writ of mandamus, or it can be appealed if there is a conviction after the trial.
Okay. So I reckon we'll get to that point eventually too. If you bumped into this judge on the street, Mr. Dershowitz, what would you say to him?
Get off the case. Why are you distorting justice this way? Look, half of America thinks that this case should not be tried in front of you. The appearance of conflict of interest is enough to disqualify you. And how about your daughter? First question I'd ask you is, have you discussed this case with your daughter at all? Do you know whether she's making money off the fact that you're presiding over a case that could result in the Democrats winning the election, which would benefit her enormously as a person who makes money off advising, you know, Schiff and Kamala Harris and other Democrats?
Of course. I want to talk about jury selection here. I find this quite fascinating, this whole process. How is it possible in a district that Biden won 85-15? And then what do we need to know about the process? I know they had a questionnaire and they asked questions like, have you ever been to a Trump rally and where do you get your news? How is it possible in a situation like this to get what we call a fair jury?
It's impossible. And the questionnaire is a dumb questionnaire. It asks questions like this. Do you hate Donald Trump so much that you can't possibly render a fair verdict? What person is going to say, I can't render a fair verdict? Yeah. Anybody say, I mean, you know, President Biden, if he were asked to serve, say, oh, I can render a fair verdict.
That one person, that one woman did, which I'm so impressed with. Well, I think she should actually be on the jury. We'll go to Mike, who's in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
You were on a jury.
Yeah, I was on a jury that basically suffered from TDS, only it was about guns.
What was the case about?
The defendant fired a shot out of a handgun at some trespassers.
Okay.
Which he knew, but it was basically, get off my property. And he fired a shot as a warning. So that's an idle threat carried out by an act. But the defendant said he just fired straight into the ground at his side. And the state said he fired at the people. So you got two conflicting reports. And the state came out and emptied his gun closet. And they're showing us his rifles. And there were state police helicopters trying to find this guy. So, you know, the police were mad. They spent a lot of time on this. The prosecutors want to show that they win their cases, you know.
Yeah.
So I think this just went a little far. Anyway.
How did you know about the jury? What about your fellow jurors? How were you aware of their TDS?
Well, because it was 11-1 when we took the vote, guilty or not. And I'm like, not guilty. and they go, well, do you see the guns? And I'm like, those guns weren't even involved. He had a handgun. Why are they showing us these rifles and shotguns?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So this is actually really important. So they were showing all the other guns just to prove that he was a crazy gun nut?
I guess that was their point.
Irrelevant.
There. And this was inner city. Irrelevant, yes.
Yeah, it's irrelevant. Wouldn't this be easy to prove, though? Like, if the bullet hit the ground right next to him, then he shot it at the ground?
That's the state or the defendant to prove. You just had witnesses. They probably didn't get forensics out. They were, you know.
So it was 11-1. So it's a hung jury because of you.
Yeah, but I didn't hang them. So the rest of the story is these people are like, you're nuts. We don't know what to do. Let's go back in and tell the judge we're hung. So the judge finally comes out. We go out, and the judge gives us. And we weren't even allowed to consider that they were trespassing. We were instructed not to consider that he tried to get these people off the property. Okay. So now it's whether the judge instructed, do you believe the defendant that he shot straight into the ground, or do you believe the prosecution that he pointed the gun at them? And there was no evidence where he shot. And a lot of this was, I think it was reckless endangerment. They go, and he got crazy theories. Well, it could have ricocheted. It could have done this or that. And I've shot guns. You shoot in the ground, it goes in the ground. You know, no one got hurt, so.
Wow, that's so interesting. First, I've heard this before where a judge will tell the jury that you can't consider a thing that is the most pivotal part of the entire case. Like, that's the point of the case is that people were trespassing on the property, but you can't consider that. That's the whole justification for what he did or didn't do.
Well, it wasn't in a home. In Pennsylvania, I guess in a home you could have shot him. But
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, don't need to literally get the whole thing, but go ahead.
After these instructions, we go back in, and they go, okay, you were right, Mike. And everybody else changed their mind.
Oh, no way. Wow, that's impressive. That's impressive.
That gets me more than anything that, you know, they got over their TDS or GDS.
Well you convinced them. That's impressive.
Well, the judge explained it like I couldn't, I guess.
Well.
You know?
Well, it would have been over before then, though, if you didn't stand up in the beginning. Then maybe wouldn't have gone back to the judge.
Coming out with what ifs and what, you know, and did you see his guns and all kinds of stuff. You know, they had derangement syndrome over guns.
Do you think there's any chance Trump gets a fair trial in New York City?
All it takes is one.
Yeah.
You know? It's tough. From what I'm seeing from the reporting and what people are saying.
That's funny. All it takes is one, but not a chance. Mike, I appreciate the comment. All it takes is one, but it'll be a hung jury. That's my prediction. It'll be a hung jury at the end of the day. Welcome back to Breitbart News Daily. Sit back and enjoy Vicky Paladino. Yesterday, we played some video of some migrants at a city council meeting in New York City, and it seemed as if they were complaining about some things, is what it came across, at least these short clips. So Vicky Paladino, one of the city council members, takes to the mic and says this.
I have to ask you, what motivated you to come here thinking the streets are paved with gold? They're not.
I said, oh, we got to talk with her. And here she is, representing a portion of Queens, New York. Miss Paladino, how are you today?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
It's great to talk to you. Thanks for being here and giving us some insight here and for being a good conservative voice on the New York City Council. What was this committee hearing about? Who were these people and what happened here?
It was okay. Let me give you a quick synopsis. It was a joint committee hearing, immigration and hospitals. Two committees come together. Whereas 1,000 or more African migrants illegal immigrants came, and we were going to listen to their testimony. And their testimony was basically, you played a short clip, and it was that I never heard a bunch of whining, crying. These are people making demands on New York in the most unrealistic manner. We have jumped off a cliff here. When we listen to people demand that we are racist. First of all, let me give it. We are racist. They hate us. Why did you bother coming here? They don't like the food. They say that offering them tampons. This is how ridiculous it got, from tampons to food, that we are racist because Africans do not use tampons. How dare you? This is how bold they were. The food. We don't eat this food. We must have. Everything was, we must have. And I just said, hey, look, you know, you came here illegally. You're unhappy here. What do you want? How much more do you want? When is enough enough? This is really totally unrealistic for our city. It's been unrealistic since it started a year and some months ago. And now to listen to a group of people who speak 3,000 different languages demand New York fit their needs, cut them out special. We're cutting everybody out special. You know, we got them on a $1,500 a month debit card. Why? Because they don't like the food. I had a respite center here in my district. I'm District 19, by the way, Northeast Queens. And we saw garbage bags filled with the food that they are given, 3 squares a day, plus snacks, constantly all day long. Some of them get their mopeds. But here's the real screw. Is when they were at this respite center and people who lived there, very residential area, were getting their doorbells rung at 2 a.m. and it was Uber Eats. They thought somebody from that house called, when in reality it was the respite center that called. But this Thursday was out of control. Mm. And I was cut off again. And one of my colleagues who went after me called me a xenophobe.
Wow.
And I've had it. And I said, I object to that. So rather than one of the chairs of either of those two committees tell her, you're out of line, they tell me, councilwoman, hey, enough is enough. You could say whatever you want. And if we, in the proper tone, which I did use, though I may not sound it now, I did use the proper tone, and I articulated, you know, a certain amount of sympathy for these people, because you have to. I mean, they it's really sad. And then when they disregard you and call you a racist and a xenophobe, and they hate New York and all this, all that we've been giving them, give me a break.
I've had it.
Everybody's had it. We're done. Okay. Really.
One thing I wanted to clarify, that these were illegal immigrants who were in front of this
committee.
Okay. So that's an important distinction, of course. So we played the clip of them complaining about the food. And they said when they break their fast after Ramadan, the food is no good. So and one reason I want to have you on too is because it very well could have been that you came on and you're like, no, you guys are all blowing this out of proportion. That was only a couple clips. It was actually a really wonderful time or whatever. I don't know. And like that clip, I gave a benefit of the doubt. I was like, maybe the food is spoiled by the time it gets nighttime after they break their fast for Ramadan. Not that it's not up to the culinary standards of these migrants' demands. You're saying, no, it's more that it's just they don't like it.
Oh, it's to their liking, yes. We don't like the food. I mean, they even said it. It was plain as day. If you play this awful hearing that lasted for 6 hours.
Wow.
I stayed, 6 hours. We had to listen to people moan and groan and complain. I stayed for just the first 2.5 hours. And then I said my piece, but I won't be mistreated by my colleagues. I will not be mistreated by my colleagues and called a xenophobe simply because I said New York cannot handle what it is that you need. And I don't know what you expected when you came here because your demands are just off the charts. And we've listened to many different groups of migrants, okay, over the last year. We've had hearings for everybody, open hearings. And this was by far the most demanding, arrogant, forceful hearing. It was horrible. Their demands are totally unrealistic, absolutely unrealistic.
So these other committee hearings you've had, have they been people from different countries or different regions of the world? Was it?
Mostly different countries. It's mostly been South American, and those folks.
Interesting. I wonder if there's something culturally different about the African migrants, illegal aliens that are coming over than perhaps Latin American illegal aliens.
Well, I can say that I don't see it's in the tone of their voices. It is in their verbiage, whereas they were just outright demanding on Thursday. The other ones maybe were a little bit more polite in their verbiage. Grateful to be here. You hear that, but when you hear what I heard on Thursday, you just want to tell them, and I did, if you play more of the clip. This is when they really cut me off, is when I said, you are here illegally. You are here illegally. And they didn't like that. And that's when one of the chairwoman cut me off. And she said, council member, do you have a question? Council member, do you have a question? I said, yes, I asked it, and I do have more. It was about the vetting, which they lied. Then she started to spew, one of the people who answered one of my questions on the panel there, she started to spew cop-hating rhetoric. We wouldn't pay our police officers so much. Are you kidding me?
Really?
You are here illegally. You're here illegally. And you're telling us that you don't like our police, okay? They took away your mopeds and your scooters. Seriously? Are they licensed? Are they insured? Okay? Or are they just something that you're going scooting around and doing Uber Eats or whatever it is you do illegally? Illegally. Let's understand this. This is all done illegally. And as soon as you say that word illegal, bam. You get crushed.
Yeah.
It's like, you're not allowed to say that.
I want to drive this home. So you're telling me a illegal alien from, in this case, from Africa, was complaining to the New York City Council that the people of New York pay their police too much money.
That is correct. Yes. You waste your money when you could be taking care of us. You waste your money on funding the police. And what is it that you have? She said, those little robots. I just couldn't. Oh my word! I really kept my cool. I was so proud of myself because you just could not believe the ridiculous seriousness of this whole thing, but they were dead serious. And what was worse, everybody out there, is that your city council, if you live in these five boroughs, was sympathetic to this. And they want to meet their needs. So understand, we are dealing with a body of people in this city council who actually believe all of this and think all of this is okay.
I wanted to ask you what the other city council members are saying and doing and thinking about this.
It's really quite upsetting because we have 51, and out of 51 city council, you have nine of us who feel differently than they do. Wow. Okay? The first thing we say is close the border. The second thing we say is because of the rise in crime, bring back ICE. The other thing we say is pull the sanctuary state status for a short period of time. Declare the city a state of emergency. Exercise some executive powers here so that we can get this under control. The buses keep coming. And let's remember this. They're not just coming by bus anymore. They're coming by plane. Biden's got this whole thing going on where he's dropping migrants, illegals off in different parts of this country by airplane. So we are no longer being able to keep track. So when this woman is telling me she was vetted, no, you were not. You are a lot. You're lying. You are lying. And they cut me off. I could not. You know, I was calm. I wasn't like this. I was calm. And I took it. And then when the colleague that followed me called me a xenophobe, I said, I take objection with that. I take objection with that. And I was furious. That's when I was furious.
Yeah,
because they could say whatever they want. My colleagues could call us xenophobes, racist, anything they like, and they get away with it. But it's just disgusting.
Yeah, you call someone an illegal alien, then it's over. We played the clip yesterday of ICE in Boston arresting an illegal alien who was previously arrested for raping a child, but the Boston police did not hand them over to ICE, and this person's been arrested for. So the illegal alien released into the country, raped a child, was arrested, released, and then ICE had to go hunt them down SWAT team style. So I'm sure this is happening rampant in New York City. Why did the mayor months ago say that this is going to destroy our city? So what is his take? And this, right, if you have these city council members who are sympathetic to it and like going along with it all, but the mayor eventually said it's destroying our city, shouldn't he be on your side?
He is. Trust me, he is. I really feel for him in a lot of ways, but you understand we need leadership. And while I feel badly for him, he needs to put his foot down and stick to it. He did discuss back in February or January, we did a press conference about bringing ICE back to a certain degree, and he was going to examine his executive powers, and he was going to talk with the governor because, you know, she could bring ICE back with a stroke of a pen. This was right after the cops got beat up in Times Square, in that Times Square area. And I want you to know, we never would have known about that had that not gone viral.
Yeah.
Had that clip not gone viral.
Yep.
So we are really in a mess because we lack the leadership that this city so desperately needs. The city council is out of control. They are unrealistic. They just don't see things it boggles your brain because you think to yourself, we're already $7.3 billion in debt. We can't keep track of the amount of people. They say it's 200,000. We had 500,000 people leave the city of New York in the last 3 years, 2.5 years. 500,000. We replaced them with 200,000. And, of course, there's more. 200,000 illegal immigrants are in this country, in the city. Now, if you do the math, and you listen to the rhetoric that was coming out a few months ago, maybe even 6 months ago, it's a little line that they use. Our new neighbors, our new New Yorkers. No. Our New York is left. These are not our new New Yorkers. They are not producing anything. We cannot give them the ability to actually get work because a lot of people are saying, give them jobs, give them jobs. What jobs are we going to give them? Answer me that. If they can't read English, and some of them can't even, they're illiterate, like the migrants that were there on Thursday. They were illiterate in their own language. They couldn't read or speak it. What are we supposed to do? You're supposed to put them on a plane and send them back. That's enough. And I said this 6-8 months ago. You need to say enough is enough. We did our fair share as New Yorkers. Now, Venezuela, we've got their gangs here now. Who do you think is committing these crimes? They hooked up with MS-13. And we've got an underground movement going on here of the worst of the worst. Venezuela is bragging, openly bragging, about how their crime has gone down. Well, sure, you shipped them all over here. They're all here. Then you had the Haitian, the prison that was emptied out. And guess where they are? They're here. And some of them were in City Hall Park. So we're giving blanket coverage to illegal immigrants. Not all are bad, but we are seeing what is happening with the crime. We see what's going on. And if you do just a little bit of homework, a little bit, scratch the surface a little bit. They don't belong here. They're not from here. They're not New Yorkers. Okay? There are new neighbors, which is a bunch of... Anyway, so there you go.
I got one last question for you, Vicky. You mentioned the streets are paved with gold. You said they're not paved with gold. Who told you that? They're not. So you said... And it reminded me of an interview I did 10 years ago, and we only got about 2 minutes, so I won't play it for you, but it was with a World War II veteran 10 years ago in Brooklyn, and he's talked about growing up in the Depression, and his dad said the streets are paved with gold, and he was a young boy, and he laughed at him, like, oh, you believe that the streets are paved with gold? They came from Ukraine. And his dad grabbed him by the arm, took him to the window, and said, look at these streets. These streets are paved with gold. Your uncle is a roofer. Your aunt is a teacher. Your other aunt is a law secretary. You have a house, and we have a house, and you go to school. These streets are paved with gold. But I never really dug deeper into that. The implication there, of course, is that you have to mine your own gold and pave your own streets.
Correct.
Why do you say the streets are not paved with gold?
They're not paved with gold anymore because everybody's getting everything for free. Nobody is working. It's a drain on our economy. You know, when you talk of the 1920s, that's my mother too, you know, and everything, this was the land of opportunity. New York was a port of call where you came, where you knew, and plus we didn't have the population that we had. We were just starting, you know, I mean, we're just turning over a new page. But these were patriotic people. These were people who wanted to assimilate. I could speak for my own when I'm Italian descent. Italian wasn't spoken in my house except when my grandfather came. But there was only like one newspaper, two newspapers. You didn't go downstairs and see, you know, 15, 20, now maybe 60 different papers in 60 different languages. You learned how to work. When you came here, you had to be sponsored. You needed to find work, and there were jobs. These people were laborers. And let me just say this. When the Italian-Americans came here at the turn of the century, and any history book will tell you this, we were considered the blacks of New York City. You know, there was a certain pecking order. Mm-hmm. And we were even beneath the Irish. And if you want to talk about slums, And you want to talk about kids begging on the street. We had it all. We had it all. But we saw that we overcame it. But you know what? There was a proper way to come into this city. Whether it was Ellis Island, I have a girlfriend whose parents came in through Chelsea Piers. This was something that if you came in, you were cattle card. And if you had an earache and you went to the medical facility, which was no picnic, this was not pretty, but you were sent back. These people are flooding. 8 million people have come into this city that we know, into this country that we know of. 200,000 of them are here. Our streets are no longer paved with gold because we cannot handle this mad rush that we've gotten in a year and a few months. Let me just cap off with this.
Yeah.
We had what was called, when the migrants, when we as European immigrants were coming here, they put a hold on it for a while. I forgot the exact name that they called it. It was like a hiatus, immigration hiatus, so that we could catch our breaths. The purpose of it was so that New York could catch its breath and that we could really count what came in here. This is in the history books. This didn't happen yesterday. This happened decades ago. I strongly suggested that about 6 or 8 months ago.
I can only imagine what they called you. Vicky, we have to run. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Please keep up the wonderful work, and I hope we could talk again. I don't know how you got on the council, but I'm glad you're there. Vicky Palladino, New York City Councilwoman. Thanks for listening to Breitbart News Daily. Slater at Breitbart.com is my email. Slater at Breitbart.com and Slater Radio on the Twitter and the Instagram. We'll see you on Monday.